Harper Audio presents Bringing Adam Home, The Abduction That Changed America by Les Standiford with Detective Sergeant Joe Matthews. Read for you by Robert Fass. After the first death, there is no other. Dylan Thomas. Chapter 1. In the beginning. Hollywood, Florida, July 27th, 1981. Shortly after lunch, on what seemed an ordinary summer afternoon, a young South Florida housewife set out on a shopping trip with her 6-year-old son in tow. It was the sort of outing that millions of other mothers all across the country might have taken on any given day. Her husband, a sales and marketing manager for a local hotel company, had noticed an ad in that morning's newspaper and called home to say that the brass barrel lamps they had been looking for had just gone on sale at the local Sears store. Maybe she ought to run over and take a look. She was happy to do it. They'd been wanting the lamps, and the chance to save a few dollars seemed too good to pass up. She freshened herself up, dressed her son in shorts, a polo shirt, flip-flops, and his favorite way-big boat captain's hat, and set out for the store. It was a Monday, typical 90-degree weather with humidity just as high, but that was July in South Florida for you. Come January, when the rest of the country was in a deep freeze, Floridians would have payback. Besides, traffic in their suburban town of Hollywood was light that early afternoon, and it was less than a 2-mile drive to the Sears Mall. As a bonus, the parking space she liked to use, near the receiving dock on the building's north side where the whole family could remember it, was open. Just inside the doors, at the entrance to the toy department, her son spotted a video display with a demo of the new Asteroids game running, and he begged his mother to let him play. She hesitated, but home furnishings was just a couple of aisles away, and besides, the world had not yet turned upside down. She pointed out to her son where she was going and told him she'd be back in a few minutes to pick him up. She gave her son a kiss then, and hurried off to see about those lamps. She would relive the moment 100, perhaps 1,000,000 times. Had she just said no to him, "Stay with me"? Had she simply returned to the game display 1 minute sooner? Had any one of 1,000 things happened differently in the slightest, as it is said that the flapping of a butterfly's wings in the Amazon can form a tsunami in a distant time and place, perhaps what occurred might not have occurred at all. But there is no changing what did happen that day. The mother found a salesperson in home furnishings easily, but there was a bit of a problem. They searched up and down the bright aisles, but could find none of the barrel lamps on display. The clerk was happy to check in the back, of course. It would only take a moment, which turned into something more. When the clerk finally returned, her downcast expression said it all. The store had not received any of the advertised lamps, but they would be happy to call the moment they came in. The mother quickly gave her name and number and hurried back to where she'd left her son. She could hear the clamor of spaceships and cannon fire tearing the air as she hurried down the aisle and smiled at her son's passion for such games. But when she rounded the corner, she stopped short. The game was running, but its stations were deserted, the sounds issuing mechanically from the demo loop. She glanced about, puzzled, hoping she would see her son browsing in the nearby toy department or ambling toward her from where she had been, but she did not. She fought the surge of panic that every mother feels when she turns and finds her child suddenly lost from sight. The ripples on the surface of the nearby pond are all menace. The sounds of distant traffic suggest catastrophe and grief and guilt. But she would not panic foolishly, this mother. She would retrace her steps. She would have the store announce her son's name, and that he should find a clerk and report himself. While store personnel stood ready, she would return to the place she had left her car. He would be waiting there, or he would come to her, or she would find him. She would not panic. She would find her son. Surely, she would find her son. Washington, D.C., February 13th, 2006. At a Capitol Hill press conference, a reporter stood to ask a final question of John Walsh, leading proponent for the about-to-be-debated Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. Walsh, a private citizen, had become perhaps America's most recognizable crime fighter owing to his work as executive producer and host of the long-running television program America's Most Wanted. But also, in the wake of the 1981 kidnapping and murder of his son Adam, he and his wife, Reveille, had dedicated much of their lives' energies to raising awareness of the problem and the plight of missing children in America. As a result of the Walshes' work had come the passage of the 1982 Missing Children Act, the establishment of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in 1984, and the National Amber Alert Program of 2003. Walsh considered the new bill that was about to go before Congress the capstone of a life's work, removing impediments to the recovery of the nearly 800,000 children who are reported missing in the United States each year. "Mr. Walsh," the reporter began, "you've done much good work on behalf of children and families everywhere, and you've brought any number of heinous criminals to justice with your television show. But I'm wondering if it ever bothers you that you have been unable, in all these years, to find out who killed your own son." It was a question asked out of ignorance, the sort of thing that made several in the room wince. Walsh managed to respond without losing his composure, but following the incident, he and Reveille contacted longtime associate and America's Most Wanted investigator Joe Matthews to set up a meeting that would prove to be momentous. As a veteran homicide detective for the Miami Beach Police Department, Matthews had supervised and conducted more than 20,000 criminal investigations and over 2,000 death and homicide investigations, and had obtained confessions and convictions in a number of high-profile cases, including Miami's infamous Baby Lollipops torture murder, that of Washington State's spree killer Chad Daniel Roberts, and Canada's University of Waterloo serial rapist Christopher Meyer. But more important, Matthews, a widely recognized polygraph expert, had been involved in the investigation of Adam Walsh's disappearance and murder from the very beginning, 25 years before. His skill and tireless efforts to bring mistakes and overlooked evidence to the attention of those in charge of that still unresolved investigation had earned him the respect and the friendship of the Walshes over the years. And following his retirement from the Miami Beach Force, Matthews had gone to work as a lead investigator for America's Most Wanted, where he was quickly credited with solving the program's first cold case investigation, the killing of a former high school wrestling champ by four football players at Lock Haven University in Pennsylvania. Matthews was well aware that for all the good work that the Walshes had accomplished over the years, there still existed a great void in their lives. Adam was gone, and though both they and he had expended vast resources and energy trying to do what the authorities had been unable to do, the person responsible had never been brought to justice. And for all the effrontery of the reporter's question, it was scarcely the first time it had been asked. The Walshes had been asking virtually the same thing of themselves, if only privately, nearly every day for a quarter century. On this day, however, Matthews could see that something different had taken over the Walshes' demeanor. Perhaps it was the pain of such a jab coming in the context of seeming triumph with the passage of the Child Protection and Safety Act. Or perhaps the Walshes had simply heard one insensitive question too many. Whatever, Matthews thought as he waited for the Walshes' words, he'd walk through fire for John and Reveille Walsh. Normally it was John who did most of the talking, but on this day Reveille took over before her husband could get started. "Joe," she told Matthews in no uncertain terms, "I'm begging you. I know it's asking a lot, but I want you to go back through everything we've all tried to show the cops over the years. I want you to give it one last shot. Put everything together and prove who killed our son, once and for all." Matthews had made his decision before Reveille was finished. He was honored that she'd even ask, he told her. He was an investigator through and through, and he had witnessed her suffering and that of her husband from the beginning of their ordeal. In truth, He had been aching for much of his adult life to do the very thing that she had just asked of him. He took her hands in his and nodded. He would give it his best shot, and he would start at once. Chapter 2. Blood of the Lamb. Do you remember if she was a hitchhiker?
Yeah, I think she was.
Did she have a name?
I wouldn't know.
Didn't you ask her name when you picked her up?
I suppose so. I didn't pay much attention to stuff like that.
Otis Toole to an investigator, Jacksonville County Jail, December 28, 1983. Miami Beach, Florida, July 31, 1981. When veteran Miami Beach PD homicide detective Joe Matthews got the call on Friday from Captain of Hollywood Detective Steve Davis asking that Matthews assist his department in the investigation of the disappearance of 6-year-old Adam Walsh, Matthews was more than willing to join in. He was well aware of the anguish that had gripped the entire South Florida community since the boy had vanished earlier in the week. The reward offered for Adam's safe return had risen to $100,000, the highest ever for a missing child in the United States, and the case, which would be likened to the Lindbergh kidnapping, had attracted the attention of news media, not to mention cops, across the region. 4 days had passed since Adam had gone missing from the Sears store in Hollywood, and though 25 officers assigned to the Hollywood PD Detective Bureau had worked the case full-time, along with assistance from officers from Broward and other South Florida counties, what scant leads they'd uncovered had come to nothing. There was no reason to suspect that Adam had simply run away or wandered off. There were no disaffected family members who might be suspected of abducting him, nor had there been any ransom note or report of anything unusual spotted at the Sears store that day. In short, there had been nothing. And in the days long before Amber Alerts, children's faces on milk cartons, and national databases that linked police departments in missing children cases, the Hollywood PD was up against a wall. Furthermore, there was good reason for Captain Davis to contact Matthews. Matthews, 35, had been employed by the city of Miami Beach since 1967 and had quickly risen through the ranks, promoted after only a year and a half as a patrolman to detective for the Criminal Investigations Division. In 1973, shortly after he married his wife, Ginny, he was promoted to the rank of detective sergeant. At about the same time, Matthews, always skilled at interrogation, had enrolled in a state-certified program for polygraph examiners, figuring the training would make him a better cop and, quite frankly, expand his prospects. He and Ginny had plans to start a family, and making do on a cop's salary was always a challenge. By 1976, Matthews had become the chief polygraph examiner for the Miami Beach Police Department and had started his own state-certified school for polygraph examiners, a sideline that became more and more profitable as word of Matthews's skills as both an investigator and an instructor spread throughout the South Florida law enforcement community. The burly, avuncular Matthews was regarded as a tough but fair cop by his colleagues, and his meticulous style of interviewing subjects prior to the actual polygraph exam itself had proven to be most effective. As he was fond of reminding his students, how can you know what kind of questions to ask if you don't know the person you're asking them of? Among those many students he had trained over the years was Steve Davis, who had even gone on to intern under Matthews at his Southern Institute of Polygraph. And while Davis considered himself an able polygraph examiner, along with others who performed the same duties within the Hollywood Police Department, many of them also trained by Matthews, in this case he wanted the best. Matthews was not only a top polygraph examiner, he was a highly regarded cop and investigator. "We need you up here," Davis told Matthews, who needed little convincing. When he had heard the initial news bulletins late on the afternoon that Adam had disappeared, Matthews's initial reaction was one of sadness mixed with some resignation. He was an experienced police officer, after all, and the world was a hard place. Maybe the Walsh boy had just wandered away and gotten lost,
Hopefully he hadn't fallen into one of the many canals that stitched the narrow habitable strip of South Florida land between the Everglades and the Atlantic. Hopefully he would turn up safe somewhere. But shortly after Matthews got home that evening, his feelings began to change. Jenny met him just inside the door, the kid's PJs tucked under her arm, wondering if he'd heard the news. He had heard, Matthews assured her. "My God, Joe," she told him then. "I was on my way to that same Sears this afternoon, but Joey got sick, and I had to turn around. It could have happened to us. That's what I keep thinking." Matthews stopped, staring back at her, feeling goosebumps prickle even his thick skin. They lived in the unincorporated area known as Southwest Ranches, then a sparsely populated area of Broward County, a few miles from the fringes of real civilization and the Hollywood store where Adam had gone missing. The houses there sat on lots of an acre or more, and some neighbors still kept horses. The urban centers of Fort Lauderdale and Miami were nearby, and if you wanted a dose of the city, you could easily get it. But out here, you could pretend you were still part of an old-time Florida, where foxes and raccoons and possums roamed. And if you were talking about predators, you meant the eagles and hawks and ospreys that still cut the skies overhead. Matthews glanced into the family room, where his brood, 4 kids in 5 years, were raising their usual clamor in front of the TV set while Scooby-Doo hightailed it from a make-believe monster. His oldest son, Joey, was almost exactly the same age as Adam Walsh, born one day before him on November 13, 1974. After Joey, there had come 2 more sons, Greg and Michael, and in 1979, just 2 weeks before Joey's 5th birthday, their daughter, Christina, was born. "The things you take for granted," he found himself thinking, a wave of dread drifting over him. It was a feeling that only increased over the course of the week as reporters continued to chronicle the lack of results in the search for Adam Walsh. By the time Davis called to issue his plea, Matthews was more than primed to help. "Anything I can do," he assured Davis, who immediately put in a call to Emmett Miller, Miami Beach police chief, asking that his former instructor be loaned to HPD to conduct interviews and polygraph examinations. "We need all the help we can get," an anxious Davis told Chief Miller, and the deal was done. Miami Beach, Florida, August 5th, 1981. In truth, the Miami Beach that Sergeant Matthews set out from to meet with his Hollywood PD counterparts the following Wednesday bore very little resemblance to the high-octane, pretty-peopled playground of today. Nor had it yet become the drug-fueled, money-laundering center of exotic crime mirrored in Miami Vice, where Crockett and Tubbs donned unstructured suits and chased swarthy miscreants in cigarette boats and Ferraris. There was crime in Miami Beach, to be sure, but it was still largely the old-fashioned variety that made its own kind of sense. From the 1930s, mob money had fueled the glittering beachfront resorts where big-name talent performed and movers and shakers cavorted. But much of that was about providing willing customers with what they craved: babes, booze, cards, and dice. Victimless crime, as it used to be called, and hardly a thing that outraged anyone, unless you happened to be standing behind a pulpit on Sunday morning. Besides, by 1981, most of the gambling action had moved on to Las Vegas and other climes, and the Eden Rocks, the Fontainebleaus, and their paler cousins up the beach were already sliding toward irrelevance. Residents of Miami Beach, as well as Americans just about anywhere, were aware of a trend toward more disturbing crimes. Truman Capote's depiction of the senseless 1959 murders of a Kansas farm family in his landmark In Cold Blood had opened the eyes of a nation to the possibility that dim-witted losers or small-time grifters might morph into homicidal maniacs at a moment's notice. 10 years later would come the stunning Manson family murders in Los Angeles. In the wake of the Clutter and Tate LaBianca killings had come a number of ghouls to command the headlines, including David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, who terrorized New York City in 1976 and 1977, killing 6 persons and wounding 7 more, in a series of shootings that he said were ordered by a demon who possessed his neighbor's dog. Even more prolific was Ted Bundy, the law student turned killer of co-eds and young women, at least 30 of them, including half a dozen in North Florida. Not only had the nature of evil begun to divorce itself from any semblance of rational explanation, it seemed, but subsequent developments would suggest that the forces of good had lost their power to respond. In 1979, 66 Americans were taken hostage in Iran, and the mighty USA, for all its bluster, appeared powerless to do anything about it. A vaunted military rescue operation failed miserably, and only the ouster of yet another president, it seemed, was enough to appease the kidnappers. Not until 444 days had passed, and Ronald Reagan had replaced Jimmy Carter, were the last 52 hostages released. There were other signs as well that fault lines had begun to split an orderly world. In December of 1980, apparent lunatic Mark David Chapman pumped 4 bullets into the back of Beatles singer John Lennon, perhaps the most beloved entertainer of his age, as he strolled arm in arm with Yoko Ono outside his Manhattan apartment. Chapman could offer no reason for the killing beyond the voice inside his head that told him, "Do it, do it, do it." The attempt on Ronald Reagan's life by John Hinckley Jr. on the following March seemed positively rational in comparison. At least Hinckley claimed that he wanted to impress actress Jodie Foster. Nor did it compare to the events of May 13, 1981, when would-be Turkish assassin Mehmet Ali Agca shot Pope John Paul II 4 times as he made an appearance in St. Peter's Square. Theories abound as to why Agca did what he did. He has been described as everything from an addled opponent of all things capitalist to an agent of the Russian KGB to a brainwashed operative of a Muslim cabal. But what was certain was that someone had actually fired bullets into the body of the Pope of the Catholic Church with the intent to kill. And yet for all the impact such actions may have had upon the underlying psyche of a civilization, it remained in some ways a doggedly innocent age. When in late 1980, Calvin Klein presented CBS TV with a jeans ad in which 15-year-old actress Brooke Shields dared to murmur, "You know what comes between me and my Calvins? Nothing." The network indignantly banned the spot. And there were other concerns to divert the attention of a nation as well. The first IBM personal computers were rolling off assembly lines. The wedding of Prince Charles and Diana Spencer was set for July 29th, and 30 million tongues were wagging that Luke and Laura from television's General Hospital would soon follow suit. So far as any national obsession with crime went, the burning question in most American minds for most of the previous year was, who shot J.R.? The final episode of the highly successful television series Dallas had ended that spring with a cliffhanger in which an unknown assailant fired a bullet into the body of overbearing Texas kingpin J.R. Ewing. More viewers than in all previous television history, an estimated 83 million, watched J.R. go down, and due to an ensuing Hollywood writers' strike, they would have to wait until late November to learn who pulled the trigger. As for ordinary crime in Miami Beach, there was no shortage of it, not given what had recently taken place in Castro's Cuba, just 90 miles from Florida. In April of 1980, some 11,000 Cubans seeking to escape the clutches of the communist regime sought refuge on the grounds of the Peruvian embassy in Havana, setting up a clamor that resounded in the world press and had the Cuban emigre community in South Florida seething. Faced with yet another political and public relations nightmare, while also loath to do anything that did not somehow redound to his own benefit, Castro hit on a solution that he considered genius. He would open the nearby port of Mariel, he announced, and allow any Cuban Americans with relatives who wanted to leave the island to come down and pick them up. The response of the Cuban community in South Florida was overwhelming. The ensuing Mariel boat lift put just about every one of the area's seaworthy craft, and a number that were not, into service shuttling refugees across the narrow Florida Straits. But the apparent gesture of mercy, in fact, came with a heavy price. In order to rid himself of undesirables who put a strain on his own social services infrastructure, Castro emptied his jails of criminals of every stripe and his mental institutions of the most deranged, shuffling these individuals into the desperate throngs that filled the docks at Mariel. In the month of May 1980 alone, almost 90,000 Cubans arrived in Miami, many of them without relatives, without education, without prospects, and many of them with long histories of violent and criminal acts. It was the beginning of the Scarface era in Miami, and the truly despicable of the Marielitos found easy pickings among the frail and the elderly in South Florida, and particularly in Miami Beach, which had long been a haven for retirees. In fact, the incident that was often talked about when Joe Matthews's name came up among those in the know was one that had taken place at about this time in South Beach, long before it became a glamorous place. For far less than the cost of a night's lodging in the Delano or the Carlisle today, a retiree in 1981 might have been able to lay down a month's rent for a room in any of the crumbling Art Deco relics that occupied the stretch of Ocean Drive from 5th to 15th. In those days, the tourists and the players were still staying well northward up the beach, and there were no buxom models or chiseled skateboarders to dodge on South Beach, no plethora of fern-draped sidewalk cafes to choose from, no daisy chain of Maseratis nosed to Lamborghinis nosed to Aston Martins clogging the streets, no $25 valet parking, no pricey boutiques selling furs for pets. In the de facto retirement village of South Beach, you had your room and your hot plate, and after some soup for supper, you could walker yourself to the elevator, jigger it down to the lobby, don your plastic nose protector and a pair of those wrap-around sunglasses the size of windshield heat reflectors, and go out to join your fellow pensioners on the hotel porch. You'd sit there in an aluminum chair welded to the next and the next. Maybe there'd be room for 20 cheek by jowl on either side of the lobby door. And you'd stare out at the lovely Atlantic through sunglasses dark enough to keep Dracula safe from disintegration. Hundreds of you on all those porches up and down Ocean Drive, like members of some strange white-beaked, dark-banded species waiting for the arrival of a ship on the darkening ocean, like you might be ready to step on board that ship and head off somewhere far, far away. It was to one such establishment, the Shoreham, that Joe Matthews and his team had been called. Matthews was at the time still a young beat cop who had been selected as part of a crime-fighting task force formed by legendary Miami Beach PD Chief Rocky Pomerantz. An informant in Chicago had passed along a tip that was relayed to the Miami Beach PD that a gang from Chicago that had knocked over some other hotels was headed south and had the Shoreham in its sights as a robbery target. It was the kind of crime that police departments were well equipped to fight, and accordingly a dozen or so cops were hidden on the premises for the first couple of nights. They posed as guests and night clerks, jammed into closets and anterooms, itching for action. But as more and more evenings passed without incident, the size of the detail was trimmed. Finally, only Matthews and two others were left to the assignment, and as yet more evenings passed uneventfully. His companions gradually became more focused on the nightly card game they set up in one of the anterooms off the lobby and the boozing that went along with it. Matthews was no teetotaler, but he was not a drunk either. He'd have a drink or two and play some cards, but invariably he'd be the last man standing by 3 or 4 a.m., left to keep an eye out on a deserted lobby while the others slept until sunup and time to go home. He'd almost fallen asleep himself the night things turned all the way around. He heard the lobby door open about 4:15 a.m. and glanced through the curtains of the anteroom where he was stationed to see that three men wearing ski masks and carrying pistols had entered the lobby. Matthews gripped the shoulder of the partner slumped face down on the table next to him. "Holy shit," he whispered. "They're here. Wake up." The answer was a muttered curse, followed by a racketing snore. As for the third member of the team, he was fast asleep in another room. Meantime, one of the bandits already had a pistol at the back of the head of the night clerk, an actual civilian who had unluckily returned to the job, and was marching him toward the safe deposit boxes. History suggested to Matthews what would happen next. The minute the boxes were open, the clerk was likely to be shot. If some bewildered pensioner stumbled onto the scene, whether drawn by the commotion or simply wandering into the lobby thinking he'd found the bathroom down the hall from his room, his fate was likely to be the same. From the start, in fact, the stakeout team, Matthews among them, had been agreed as to strategy. It was a simpler time in law enforcement. These were bad people they'd been sent to deal with. The thugs would be given a chance to surrender, but if one of them tried anything stupid, and they might well be afforded the chance to, there'd be justice dispensed on the spot. "Whatever it takes," was the task force's watchword. Chief Pomerantz had made that much clear. However, any previous thoughts of strategy were gone from Matthews's mind now. It was him versus three. Even though he'd recently gone through the FBI's SWAT and sniper training academy in Quantico, he knew that a shootout would not work in his favor. At the same time, he was not going to hide out in an anteroom and hope that just this once the gang would be content to empty a safe and leave a potential witness behind unharmed. Matthews offered up an unspoken prayer, hoisted the shotgun leaning against the wall nearby, and eased silently out the door of the anteroom into the lobby. He carried about 185 pounds on his big-boned 5'10" frame, but he wasn't counting on his size to accomplish anything. Instead, he racked a shell into the chamber of the shotgun, a sound that rarely fails to gain a criminal's attention. "If any of you move, you're dead," he called to the three, the Browning braced at his shoulder. "At least some of you will be," he was thinking. "Put your guns down now," he added, "and put your hands behind your heads." "Put down your guns and hold up your hands," Matthews heard the mocking echo of his own words in his head. "Oh, sure," he thought, preparing himself for the fusillade to come next. But amazingly, that is exactly what the three men did, and Matthews had handcuffed them all by the time anyone else came to. It is the kind of story that cops love, and just one more reason why Steve Davis wanted Matthews's help on what was by far the most challenging case his department had ever faced. The Hollywood PD was considered one of the most efficiently run in Broward County. But as the days rolled by without any trace of Adam Walsh and public scrutiny intensified, it was becoming clear that what was essentially a small-town force, the 1980 population of the city was just over 120,000, was in well over its head. The department had a new building, a data-crunching computer paid for by federal funds, a citizens' crime watch with more than 4,000 volunteers, and an active, visible chief in Sam D. Martin, proud of such accomplishments as Operation Reindeer, which had been successful in driving down the number of shopping mall robberies at holiday time. But the truth was that Hollywood, Florida, despite its proximity to the glamour towns of South Florida, was an outpost of mom-and-pop America. Drive a couple of miles inland from the beach, and you might as well be cruising the strip mall barons of Dubuque or Des Moines. Yet if the place was ordinary, it was becoming clear by the hour that the Adam Walsh case was anything but. According to FBI figures, somewhere between 750,000 and 800,000 children under the age of 18 are reported missing in the United States each year, an average of more than 2,000 a day. Of these, the vast majority are runaways or young children who wander off and are quickly found. Another 250,000 or so turn out to have been taken by a feuding spouse or family member or a friend involved in a family dispute. A very few missing children turn out to have met with some tragic accident. Fewest of all are the victims of what statisticians call stereotypical kidnapping, where a child is taken by someone he does not know or knows only slightly. Someone who holds the child overnight, transports him more than 50 miles, demands a ransom, or intends to keep the child forever, or, woe upon woe, someone who kills the child. Only about 100 children a year are the victims of such a kidnapping, making the odds of losing a child to illness or accident far greater. But parents have been programmed from the beginning of time to cope with the specter of a fatal illness or accident, no matter how tragic. Terrible as such losses are, they at least occur within the bounds of reason. In contrast, the concept that another human being might have taken one's son or daughter is simply not part of the rational equation of parenthood, or at least it was not in 1981. Yet with every day that passed in the case of Adam's disappearance, the odds increased exponentially that no good end would come. And still, for all that, and for all the assurances that Steve Davis had given Joe Matthews about how much they needed him on board, it didn't take Matthews long to discover that his association with the Hollywood PD was going to be something other than a honeymoon. Matthews was familiar with the spacious new headquarters building at 3250 Hollywood Boulevard, having been called there several times in the past to lecture on interrogation methods and polygraph examination techniques. But moments after he parked his unmarked Plymouth sedan and entered the building on this go-around, he encountered the first in what would be a long series of challenges to his involvement in the case. Inside the building, Matthews reported to Lieutenant Dick Hines, who worked under Steve Davis in supervising the detective bureau. All went smoothly enough at first. Hines, whom Matthews had never met, was a heavy-set old-timer who carried maybe 240 pounds on his 6-foot frame. The kind of guy Central Casting would send over if you called and asked for a cop. The two exchanged a few pleasantries, then Hines walked him down a corridor to the desk of Detective Jack Hoffman, lead investigator on the Adam Walsh case. Hines explained to Hoffman that Matthews had come up from Miami Beach to lend a hand in interviewing and polygraph examinations. Hoffman glanced up impatiently from a report in front of him. He was a heavy-set, dark-haired guy with a bushy mustache that accentuated the droop of his lips. He looked like a guy who disapproved of most things on general principle, Matthews thought. "Why do we need somebody from Miami Beach?" Hoffman asked Hines brusquely. He hadn't so much as glanced at Matthews. "We've got our own polygraph people." "This is the guy who trained our people," Hines offered, but Hoffman turned back to his report without a word. Matthews thought it an unnecessary display of territory marking, but he'd been around a lot of cops. Some guys just seemed to think it necessary to protect their turf. Besides, he knew Hoffman was under considerable pressure, and after all, he'd come up from Miami Beach to help, not start trouble. He shrugged and followed Hines out of the room without comment. "Anyway, we want you to start with the father," Hines told Matthews as they walked back down the hall, and Matthews nodded. It was natural. Something goes wrong, a spouse is shot, a child goes missing. You begin by looking at the people closest to the situation. Law of averages. Hines suggested that they set up the polygraph exam for the day after tomorrow. Meantime, Matthews could familiarize himself with the case files and review what John Walsh seemed to know about his son's disappearance. On Friday, Matthews would go to work on Walsh himself. Hollywood, Florida, August 7, 1981. If they had in fact shown him everything, Matthews concluded after studying the files, then indeed the Hollywood PD did not have much to go on. According to her statement, Reve Walsh had run up and down the aisles of the Sears store for a few minutes after she'd returned and found her son gone, calling for Adam by his nickname, "Cooter, Cooter, where are you?" Finally, she spotted a store security guard, 17-year-old Kathy Schaffer, and rushed to Schaffer to report that she had lost her child. Reve reached into her wallet and pulled out Adam's first-grade picture to show it to Schaffer. "Look, he's even wearing this same shirt," Reve said, pointing at the red-and-white striped shirt she'd dressed him in that morning. Schaffer studied the photograph for what seemed a maddening amount of time, then finally shook her head. "We can page him, though," Schaffer told Reve, who glanced at her watch. It was almost 12:45. She and Adam had entered the store almost 45 minutes ago. Reve waited nearby while Schaffer made a call, then listened as the announcement crackled over the store's PA system. "Adam Walsh, please report to the information desk. Adam Walsh, your mother is waiting for you." "It was like I was drowning in a pool and couldn't reach the edge," Reve would say, trying to describe how unreal her world had suddenly become. "I was trying to reach my child, but he couldn't hear me. I felt so helpless. I kept thinking that if I could just get everything to slow down for a minute, then I could catch my bearings and catch hold of everything. And then I could reach out and pull Adam back." The announcements were repeated again at 1 p.m. and every 15 minutes thereafter, but Adam did not appear. Reveille questioned every store employee she could find, but no one remembered seeing Adam, and worse yet, none seemed too concerned. By 1:55, 2 hours after Adam's disappearance, Reveille was nearing hysteria. Using a Sears phone, she called the Hollywood police to report that her son was missing. Then, fighting back tears, she called her husband John at work and told him what had happened. By the time John Walsh arrived at the mall, it was almost 3 p.m., and a cluster of Hollywood police cruisers were nosed up to the curb outside the garden entrance to the Sears store, their flashers whirling. He parked quickly and ran inside to find a distraught Reveille speaking intently with a policeman. When she turned, he saw the desperation in her face. As he put it, "For the first time in my life, I understood what real fear was." Still, Walsh did his best to calm Reveille, and the two of them worked painstakingly to describe their son to the investigating officers, who had already put out word of a child gone missing at the Sears Mall. Local news station WINZ broadcast an announcement of Adam's disappearance, and Miami television stations interrupted programming to run Adam's photograph and a plea for any information. Friends and neighbors were standing by at the Walsh house, little more than a mile from the store. They'd call if Adam wandered home. Police were sympathetic, but there was little that they could do except broadcast the alarm. As the day wore on and the shadows lengthened, one cop pointed out the location of the police station, ironically located just a short walk across the mall's vast parking lot. "We're right over there," he told the Walshes, as if the statement meant something. As the hours passed and the store began to prepare for closing, the reality of Adam's disappearance heightened for the Walshes. It was almost as long as the lights in the aisles burned brightly, Adam might somehow come around the corner of one of the aisles, smiling with his arms outstretched. He'd just been hiding. Nothing bad had happened. But once the store closed and all was dark, what then? John rushed home and returned to the lot where Reveille waited by the family car. He'd brought blankets and some of Adam's favorite books and toys. Together, they made up a little bed in the big back seat of the family car, a converted Checker taxi. Reveille folded Adam's favorite blue blanket up to make a pillow. They left the doors unlocked and left a note on the dashboard that could be read through the window. "Adam, stay in the car. Mommy and Daddy are looking for you." And finally, sometime after the lights of Sears had blinked out and the parking lot had emptied except for the hulking shadow of the Checker, the two of them got in John's car and drove home. Any thought of rest, however, was impossible. Shortly after they'd pulled into the drive and consulted briefly with the family and friends who had gathered, Reveille mounted her bicycle and was pedaling up and down the streets of their suburban neighborhood, calling her son's name. She returned to circle the shuttered Sears store, peering through the darkened windows for any sign of Adam, and even made her way up a set of fire stairs to the roof, where she called for him down the building's ventilator shafts. As Reveille searched, John joined with a team of friends and neighbors to form a human chain that swept the nearby Hollywood golf course. A group of Crime Watch volunteers organized a walking search of the city, aided by a police helicopter that swept the streets with its spotlight. At one point late in the night, John Walsh hailed a cruiser driving through his neighborhood. "How's the hunt going?" The patrolman behind the wheel was a rookie named Mark Smith, who pointed to a photo of Adam pinned to his visor. "We're all looking for him," Smith said. "Don't worry." But still, there was nothing. By morning, the news had hit the local papers, with the local Hollywood Sun-Tattler running a front-page banner. "Massive search launched for boy, 6. Adam Walsh disappeared from Sears Monday afternoon." A piece in the Miami News quoted Hollywood police as saying that while 6-year-old Adam Walsh had indeed gone missing, kidnapping is not suspected. And in fact, there was little concrete reason at that moment to believe that an abduction had taken place. There was no ransom note, no disgruntled parent held at arm's length by divorce, none of the logical reasons for a child to be taken. John Walsh, however, could not shake the feeling that someone who had recently lost a child to some tragic circumstance might have taken his son. Yet even that scenario was preferable to the most logical explanation for many a missing child case in South Florida. The spidery network of drainage canals that intersect the narrow strip of habitable land between the Everglades and the Atlantic, the crackpot work of developers such as Henry Flagler and Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, had claimed more than their fair share of children over the years. It is hard to drive a mile in South Florida without encountering one of the deeply chiseled, rock-walled channels meant to turn the Everglades into home sites, few of them fenced, many of them abutting parks, bike paths, and heavily traveled thoroughfares. If Adam had tumbled into one of those canals, well, it was a prospect John Walsh did not want to contemplate. And despite the efforts of the local police and news media, there was the distressing possibility that Adam and his abductor were long gone from the area. In 1981, there were none of the regional and national alert systems and shared databases that the public and the law enforcement community take for granted today. Despite the fact that hundreds of thousands of children went missing each year, the world had simply not recognized the need for such measures. Most kids showed up, right? Such disappearances were ordinarily treated by law enforcement as local matters. But by now it seemed to the Walshes that Adam was not simply going to show up. And if he had indeed been taken, and his abductor had slipped them outside the local network of cops and media alarum, who would even notice? To try and cover such bases, the Walshes designed a poster offering a reward of $5,000, no questions asked, for Adam's safe return. It featured a photograph taken only a week before, a gap-toothed little boy in a baseball cap holding a bat, and assured anyone who might have taken Adam, "Do not fear revenge. We will not prosecute. We only want our son." They printed 150,000 of the posters, and they did a thing unheard of at the time. Through friends with connections to Delta Airlines, copies were given to every passenger who passed through the airline's busy Atlanta hub. Copies, including those translated into Spanish, were distributed on every outgoing flight at the Fort Lauderdale Airport. Eastern Airlines followed suit, and soon the posters were being issued to their passengers at every airport in the United States. By Wednesday, 48 hours after Adam's disappearance, it seemed almost certain there would be no simple resolution to the case. "Probes yield no clues to missing boy," the headlines read. "Reward rises as police probe any, every clue." Fred Barbetta, public information officer for the Hollywood PD, assured reporters that the cops had spared no effort. "We've got the whole detective bureau on this one," he told reporters. "The whole patrol, everybody." But then he added a grimmer assessment, one that reflected what many inside the department had come to think. "It's time we hit the waterways hard. If he's in the water, this is when he'd come up." As a result, those same volunteers who'd scoured the streets and combed the parks and playgrounds and golf courses began to walk the banks of the dark canals. On Thursday, lead detective Hoffman made his first public statement on the case, telling reporters that Adam's disappearance might possibly have been an abduction after all. "This is not the type of child to just walk off," he explained. He'd had considerable discussion with the parents, and they had convinced him that Adam was a well-behaved and happy little boy. "But we don't have any clues whatsoever what the motive would be. It's extremely frustrating," Hoffman added. "We've got no clues, no leads, no evidence, and no motives." Hoffman reiterated his department's plea for anyone who might have witnessed anything out of the ordinary that day at the Sears Mall to come forward. Meanwhile, certainly no one had given up the search. 22 Hollywood police officers had volunteered their unpaid overtime to keep looking for Adam. Influenced by the Hollywood PIO's grisly reminder that gases inside a decomposing body would by now have sent it floating to the surface of the water, the Florida Game and Freshwater Fish Commission donated one of their helicopters for use in searching area waterways. 7 wildlife officers volunteered their time to conduct a ground search in the nearby Florida Everglades. Revay, desperate for anything that might help, agreed to undergo hypnosis in the hopes that she might have blocked some detail, however small, of her activities that Monday. But the account she gave of her activities under hypnosis was depressingly similar to that of her conscious recollections. Her memory of the timing of events matched to the minute, and she had seen nothing out of the ordinary and no one suspicious on her way into the store that day. Meantime, the press had set up camp outside the Walsh's more than modest Hollywood home, eagerly trumpeting any tidbit they picked up off their police frequency scanners. They had taken to describing John Walsh as a marketing executive in their stories, and somehow the converted Checker cab had become a custom car. While the reward was bumped up to $25,000 and ultimately $100,000 through the donations of friends, the Walshes had begun to fear that they were being painted as millionaires, the type of people who might be targeted for a colossal ransom. And then, late on Thursday, came a phone call that finally gave Hollywood police some reason to hope. A woman named Marilyn Pottenberg phoned, explaining that her 10-year-old son Timothy told her that he had noticed something suspicious during their visit to the Sears store the afternoon that Adam Walsh disappeared. She herself had not witnessed it, Mrs. Pottenberg said, but her son told her that he had seen Adam, or someone who looked like Adam, being pulled into a dark blue van in the parking lot. Mrs. Pottenberg was not eager to have her son interviewed by police because he suffered from severe migraine headaches. She would have to speak with Timothy's doctor before she could allow that. She would get back to them. Though there were certain inconsistencies in the tip, including the suggestion that Timothy had witnessed this event long after the time that Reveille Walsh had raised the alarm for her missing son, Lieutenant Hines appeared before reporters on Saturday, August 1st, to announce that his force was following up on the first solid lead they had uncovered to date, and he put out the call to anyone in the community who might have seen such a suspicious vehicle. The local Crime Stoppers staged a reenactment of an Adam lookalike being snatched through the doors of a blue van by a white male perpetrator, and the footage was aired on every local television station. Tips flooded in from everywhere, and hundreds of vans of every shade of blue were stopped and searched by cops in Palm Beach, Broward, and Dade counties. Florida highway troopers were doing the same across the entire state. But by the following Tuesday, 8 days after Adam had disappeared, even Lieutenant Hines was backpedaling. He'd come to have some misgivings about the veracity of the Pottenberg tip, he told the press, and, too, he was a bit concerned about inconveniencing innocent citizens, some of whom had been stopped and searched twice. So this was where he had come in, Joe Matthews thought, dropping the last of the case files on his desk. Beyond the blue van lead, which seemed about as consequential to him as a sighting of the Loch Ness Monster, precious little had been developed over 10 days and thousands of man-hours of police work. Furthermore, during the time that he had spent at Hollywood Police Headquarters, he'd noticed a few disconcerting things about the way the investigation was being handled in the offices around him. While Matthews sat at a vacant desk, poring over the files that were rather grudgingly parceled out to him, the phones at other desks were ringing constantly. While some of the detectives seemed organized, others assigned to the case would answer incoming calls randomly, jot information given by tipsters on scraps of paper or napkins or whatever might be handy, then hurry out on unrelated assignments without bothering to log their calls. Desks were shared, files piled and unpiled, scraps of paper sent fluttering, napkins balled and tossed and swept. To Matthews, it seemed impossibly chaotic. It wasn't that the detectives seemed incompetent or unconcerned. There simply seemed to be no one in charge. In his own department, all calls pertaining to a specific investigation went through one central logging station, and each lead, however lunatic or promising on the face of it, was assigned to someone for follow-up. After the leads were checked, reports were filed, and someone with authority over the case regularly reviewed the status of each and every inquiry, no matter how unimportant it might appear. Such organization seemed to Matthews the first principle of effective investigation technique, but when he mentioned the seeming disarray to Hoffman, he got only a raised eyebrow in return. If Hoffman had anything to say about it, Matthews wouldn't be there to begin with, he was reminded. Matthews was hardly surprised at Hoffman's response, but he couldn't have stopped himself from making his point. 10 days gone by and not a scrap of worthwhile information turned up, how could he keep his mouth shut? He even walked down the hallway to repeat his concerns to Lieutenant Hines. Hines gave him a look obviously meant to remind Matthews who was in charge. "I'll look into it," he told Matthews. Matthews got the picture. He'd stick to what he could do, he thought, what he'd been authorized to do. And he would begin with the father of the missing boy. Matthews had formed no impression as to any involvement that John Walsh might have had in the crime that he'd been called to help investigate. Impressions only got in the way. What Matthews relied upon was his technique. Before conducting a polygraph exam, any competent expert performs something of a pre-exam interview with a subject. But in Matthews's case, those interviews were anything but perfunctory. Though he has thought about the matter, he is not exactly certain where his ability to connect with people comes from, though he does recall that as a child growing up in a devout Catholic household, he'd thought he was going to become a priest. When it got closer to the time to go away to the seminary, though, I wasn't so sure. My mother knew I was upset and sat me down one day to tell me it was okay if I didn't want to go. I didn't have to be a priest just to please her, she told me. He shrugs. It was a big relief to me at the time, but sometimes I think being a cop is almost the same thing. In any event, when his subject on the day of August 7, 1981, sat down in the examining room, Matthews started by asking, "Tell me a little about yourself, John." When Walsh began by telling Matthews where he'd gone to college and what his major had been, Matthews held up a hand. "No, I mean, tell me about how you grew up. About your mother and father. Like if I asked you to rate them on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being tops, and why, that kind of thing." On that day, that kind of thing went on for almost 7 hours. Prompted by Matthews, Walsh said that if 10 were tops, then his father, a hard-working war hero he had idolized, was probably a 12 in his eyes. Walsh and his mother had what he considered a normal relationship. There were typical mother-son issues between them, but he loved her and she had always been supportive of him. Give her an 8. Matthews and Walsh did get around to a discussion of college, though it took a while. He was an English major at the University of Buffalo in New York when he met Rivet, though he'd been stunned to discover she was still in high school at the time. Even though she was 5 years younger than he was, he'd found her so poised and so intelligent. From the moment they met, there had been no one else for him, Walsh told Matthews. They'd been married for 10 years, since July 1971. Walsh also told Matthews a story from his days as a pool manager and lifeguard at the Diplomat Hotel out on Hollywood Beach. He was keeping watch at the pool one afternoon when he saw a group of kids rushing toward him from the nearby jetty. Frantic, they told him that one of their friends was in trouble out by the jetty's end, where a massive discharge pipe emptied runoff water into the ocean. They'd been playing near the mouth of the pipe when the tide shifted in and trapped their pal, lodging him in a crevice against the rocks. The boys had tried, but they couldn't get him out. The force of the incoming tide was just too strong. John ran out to the end of the jetty and scrambled down the rocks to find matters just as the boys said. Indeed, there was a kid lodged between the rocks and the mouth of the pipe, the waters rising inexorably toward his chin. And as if it could be worse, he realized that he knew this child. It was John Monahan, Jr., son of the diplomat's chief executive, trapped there in the rising waters. He'd given the boy a series of scuba lessons earlier that summer. He managed to get young John calmed somewhat, then tried pulling him out of the crevice by the arms, but it wasn't working. The water was close to the boy's chin when John called to the kids watching from the top of the jetty for help, but they couldn't understand what he wanted. "You've got to hang on," he said, turning to young Monahan. "I'm coming right back." Then he bounded up the rocks and back to the pool storage shack where the diving equipment was stored. He kicked the door open, found a tank, mask, and regulator, and raced back along the jetty to Monahan. "We're going to do it just like we did it in the pool 100 times, he assured the boy, helping him into the gear as the waters rose over his head. Once the boy had been reassured and was breathing in a passable way, Walsh slipped under the water and put his arms around Monahan's chest. He pushed hard with his feet, levering against the rocks, and suddenly, as if a cork had popped from a bottle, the boy was free. Needless to say, the incident made John Walsh far more than a trusted employee at the Diplomat. When Walsh and Reveille got married, Monahan's father insisted on paying for a honeymoon trip to Europe for the couple, and the Walshes and the Monahans had remained friends ever since. It was a captivating story, but it was the sort of thing that Matthews encouraged for other reasons. You get someone talking about emotional things they haven't thought about in 10 or 20 years, you establish a good baseline, he says. When you finally get around to asking about some crime they may or may not have been involved in just the other day, you can judge any little changes in body language, in rate of speech, or eagerness to respond, and so on, and know you may be on to something. As for the polygraph instrument itself, Matthews says, it's not infallible. It's just a tool that helps validate the information that is gathered during the interview. The polygraph can indicate deception, but only a confession establishes guilt. At the end of his time with Walsh, and following the administration of the polygraph exam itself, Matthews felt he had his unequivocal answer, however. It is the examiner's opinion that Mr. Walsh was not criminally involved, nor has he guilty knowledge as to who is responsible for the abduction of his son, Adam. On the other hand, Matthews did come across one item of interest during his interview, one that would affect the investigation irrevocably. As they talked, Walsh brought up a name that had surfaced nowhere else in the course of the investigation. It was that of Jimmy Campbell, a man Walsh identified as Adam's godfather. Campbell was a younger man whom Walsh had gotten to know at the Diplomat Hotel in his lifeguarding days. Campbell was a pool boy, a decent, hard-working kid who'd never had much of a home life or any chance for a college education, and Walsh had always liked him and felt sorry for him. Dudley Do-Right, he nicknamed him. When the Walshes started to move up in the world and he and Reveille bought a house, Walsh and his wife invited Campbell to live in one of the spare rooms. He was to help out around the place and get himself into the community college. As long as he stayed in school, he could stay with the Walshes. But if Campbell quit school or flunked out, he'd have to leave. That was the deal. Unfortunately, Jimmy had dropped out of school a few months ago, Walsh told Matthews during their interview, and Walsh had been true to his word. So where is this Jimmy Campbell now? Matthews asked, casually enough, after their exam had ended. Dudley? Walsh shrugged, clearly still disappointed with his former ward. He's out there helping with the search. Matthews took another look at Hoffman's list of subjects to be examined, which Hines had passed along. No Jimmy Campbell among them. A guy living in the Walsh house until a few months ago, intimately connected to the family, and he's not on the list? He glanced back at Walsh. You got this Campbell's phone number? Walsh was puzzled, but he was already reaching into his pocket for his address book. Matthews jotted down the information, and by 9 p.m. that evening, Jimmy Campbell was in the examining room at Hollywood PD, and Joe Matthews was hard at work on his next subject. Hollywood, Florida, August 8, 1981. In the wee hours of Saturday morning, Matthews finished his work with Jimmy Campbell. He was tired, and what he had learned during his interview with Campbell had wearied him even more. He completed his notes on the examination and took a walk down the hall to Detective Hoffman's desk. Yeah? Hoffman asked in his normal, surly fashion when Matthews approached. I finished with John Walsh, Matthews said. It took you long enough, Hoffman said, with a glance at his watch. So what's the story? Matthews shook his head. He's clean. No involvement, no guilty knowledge. Hoffman said nothing, but he seemed anything but pleased. So who's next? I already did next. A guy named Jimmy Campbell. Hoffman stared back, surprised. That name's not on the list. I know, Matthews said, and then began to explain why he had called Campbell in and what he had learned during the interview. When he finished, Hoffman was beside himself with excitement. That's it. There's our fucking guy, he said, halfway out of his seat. Matthews held up his hand. "What are you talking about? You're not even listening to me." He pointed to his notes where everything of real importance was spelled out. "The following are the relevant questions asked of Mr. Campbell during his polygraph examination. Concerning Adam's disappearance, do you intend to answer all my questions truthfully? Answer, yes. Do you know who took Adam? Answer, no. Do you know where Adam is now? Answer, no. Did you conspire with anyone to cause Adam's disappearance? Answer, no. Are you withholding information from the police concerning Adam's disappearance? Answer, no. Do you suspect anyone of taking Adam? Answer, no. Do you know who took Adam? Answer, no. Did you take Adam? Answer, no. I worked him every which way. He's not involved, Matthews assured Hoffman. Bullshit, Hoffman responded, shaking Matthews's report between them. You tell me the guy was living in the house, doing what you say he was, and he's not involved in the crime somehow? Matthews sighed. He knew